I think a dozen on 2745, or a dozen on the Rainbow, and about 10 or so on 2745. We've got two on 2910.
Okay, I'm going to put Travis at the end.
Okay.
And I'm going to begin.
Excellent.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this House Transportation Policy Committee, Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. We have a very full agenda this morning, so we are going to move along swiftly. In deference to our Senate colleague who is with us this morning, I would like to move to House Bill 2320 and open a public hearing and allow Senator Steiner Hayward to testify, and then we'll get back to our regular schedule. Thank you so much for being here this morning, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for your kindness in allowing me to testify early. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate, District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton. And I just want to testify very briefly. My constituent, Ken Walker, approached me last fall explaining a situation where he had to register his boat as a motorized vehicle despite the fact that it's a kayak that he just attaches a little electric motor onto occasionally when they're trying to fight the wind, and said that the registration fees were a little high. I agreed with him, being a kayaker myself, although I don't have an electric motor, and I want to thank Scott Bruin and Rachel Graham from the Marine Board for working with us and with Ken to develop an amendment to their bill to solve this problem. We want to support boaters of every kind in this state, and Ken brought an important situation to our attention, and I'm grateful to the Marine Board for doing it, and I just want to thank you, the committee, for considering, obviously, the Marine Board bill and our amendment to that bill, which they support, and you'll hear more about from them. But it's a really simple little fix for our constituents that allows a different kind of boating in this state than was previously considered under our regulations, and it offers a little bit more flexibility and economy for people pursuing this. So thank you very, very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you so
your
much, Senator,
for letting me testify
any
early.
Questions for the good senator? All right.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2320, and we will come back to that. And we will, let's see. Yeah, let's do that. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2910. This actually is at the request of Representative Barreto, who is not able to be here today. I would like to know if there's anyone in the audience who has come to testify on House Bill 2910 this morning. Yes, sir. Gentlemen, would you come forward, please? I believe I have listed Mr. Ludwig, Mr. Ullman, and Mr. Fuller. Daryl, are you here as well? Would you like to all come up together? Thank you. I appreciate you being here this morning. I'm sorry that Representative Barreto is not here to kind of tee this up. I will look to Mr. Walker to kind of set the stage for what this conversation is about, and then we'll go ahead with your testimony.
Chairman Kuhn, members of the committee, House Bill 2910 requires snowmobiles and certain all-terrain vehicles to cross highway at intersection or 100 feet from intersection, and allows a road authority to authorize incidental use of highway right-of-way, including paved portion, shoulder, inside bank or slope, and median of any divided highway that the road authority has designated as an all-terrain access route. This bill came out of the All-Terrain Vehicle Advisory Committee under the House Bill, Senate Bill 192, established an all-terrain vehicles work group, and these recommendations came out of that work group. So this would be the results of the work.
Gentlemen, in any order you choose.
Go ahead. Stuck in the middle. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Power Sports Association. We're the dealers that sell a lot of these vehicles, and we support the bill. I did want to just point out one section that we have a couple of questions about that may be resolved without amendment, but if the bill is going to move forward, we'd like to engage in the conversation. It's on page 2, lines 36 through 39. It has to do with the signage required in order for one of these sections to be used. And the first thing that came to my mind when I read that section is I was not altogether clear whether the signs are being posted for the vehicles that may encounter somebody crossing the road, or if the signage that was required is intended to be facing away from the road and towards people that may be on these vehicles so that they know what areas of a road they can cross. And so I think it might be helpful to know sort of who the audience is that the signs are belonging to, so that we know what direction the signs are going to be facing. The other thing that caused me concerns is the language of the statute there says that the signs have to be erected in order for that area of the road to become effective as a crossing point. So I'm wondering if somebody could be cited if a sign got knocked down, for example. If it really requires there to be a sign there for permission to be granted, if a county were to adopt several different areas for crossing, but they hadn't got all the signs up yet, does that mean even though the county or the local jurisdiction had approved an area and somebody used it as a crossing, but the sign hadn't been put up yet, but so that they could then be cited just because the signs hadn't been erected yet? It seems to me that a lot of the bill is permissive to what local governments do, and so I was just wondering at first blush whether or not the requirement for signage and how that would work might be permissive as opposed to mandatory. But with that caveat, we support the bill. We certainly wouldn't want to slow its process based on our questions, but if there's going to be some work on the bill, we would be glad to participate in that conversation on that portion of the bill, and I appreciate any questions you have and the opportunity to testify.
And Mr. Fuller, Representative Barreto is excused today, so we will be rolling this bill over to next week. I know that ODOT has some information they would like to bring to us regarding this bill, so I'm certain you'll have an opportunity to either work with Representative Barreto or work with ODOT to make sure that your concerns are brought forward.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Ethan Lodwig. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I'm a lifelong off-highway motorcycle enthusiast and current president of the Emerald Trail Riders Association. I'm here to represent the Emerald Trail Riders Association and the Oregon Motorcycle Rider Association. We would like to voice our support for HB 2910. Off-highway motorcyclists support this bill because there's a growing need for off-highway vehicle recreationalists to be able to ride on rural roads in order to access trailheads and being able to access rural communities. The satisfaction of a riding adventure is greatly enhanced when a loop route involves destinations. Being able to access restaurants, fuel, and rural communities means that our adventure can last all day instead of a few hours. Being able to access lodging means that one can create multi-day adventures carrying a credit card instead of 30 pounds of gear. Oregon's rural towns are in desperate need of our recreation dollars. Many areas around Western Oregon have embraced this idea, enhancing citizens' quality of life and allowing businesses to thrive. Riders will trailer their vehicles long distances in search of a riding adventure that can incorporate trails in the backcountry and access to rural towns for fuel, food, supplies, and overnight lodging. I have been to many organized events that start in a community's fairground or parking lot. You ride from there to mountain trails, drop into a rural town for lunch and fuel, go back to the mountains, and end up back at the staging area in town. You take a shower, you go to a nice restaurant, and overall it's a fantastic weekend. Participants will spend hundreds of dollars in a weekend doing these activities. HB 2910 would help improve trail interconnectivity and reduce the concentration of OHV users. Reduced concentration of users reduces safety concerns. Increasingly, federal land managers have had less funding to maintain access roads for resource extraction. Many of these roads can be designated as trails without financial liability of a road. HB 2910 would allow access to these trails costing very little, but giving the public a much-needed recreation resource, reinvigorating our spirits to tackle work again on Monday. Please support HB 2910, and thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. And I would like to say that the work group that went on was very productive, and we support the recommendations from that work group.
Great, sir. Thank you very much for your testimony. Sir, welcome.
Thank you. My name is John Olmland. I am an owner of a power sports store located at 1790 West 7th in Eugene, Oregon. I'm an outdoor highway enthusiast, a member of the Oregon State Parks Recreation Department Senate Bill 192 Working Committee. I have a three-year appointment with the Bureau of Land Management Resource Advisory Committee, and I'm an administrator for the Willamette Side-by-Side Riding Group, a group of over 425 side-by-side enthusiasts that self-organizes rides utilizing Facebook. I am also co-sponsor for the annual Willamette Side-by-Side Festival in Oak Ridge with the Chamber of Commerce. The following represents my viewpoint and not that of the Senate Bill 192 Working Committee, nor BLM. I am in support of HB 2910. When we started our business over 3 years ago, our customers' biggest question was where to ride. We're tired of just sand. In search of the answer, I was surprised and became active in working to promote better access for the OHV riding community. Oregon has some of the best riding in our nation, almost a state secret. Our national forests are truly scenic wonderlands, waterfalls, wildlife, geological wonders, pure scenic beauty, all at our doorstep, except we have an issue accessing this wonderland. Due to the nature of our landscape and history of forest management, we have barriers to easy access. This is mainly due to our changing technology and increasing popularity of off-highway vehicles, the barrier, pavement, and laws. Generally speaking, OHVs are not currently allowed on pavement unless a local road authority has granted access. This ability to grant access is little known and sparsely used. And due to a lack of coordination between road authorities, rules for use vary, thus creating a new barrier to accessing our riding areas. An example. One road authority may require windshield wipers if you have a full windshield, while another may not. HB 2910 will help set the standards and provide a process for granting access. Communities are eagerly awaiting leadership in this area. With the adoption of HB 2910, confusion over standards can be addressed. More importantly, increased ridership due to easier access to riding areas will contribute to much-needed economic growth for all of our rural communities. I would recommend the following modifications to the proposed bill. One, require drivers to have liability insurance. Two, require drivers to be at least 16 years old with a valid driver's license unless directly supervised by a licensed driver. Three, allow expense reimbursement for advisory committee members when traveling on committee business. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I and the OHV riding community thank you for the opportunity and a positive consideration for this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Could I have Representative McLean?
To that last comment about driver's licenses, wouldn't they have to have a driver's license during part of the ride anyway?
Let's take a family going out, mm-hmm. and they have kids under the age of 16.
Okay.
So in that case, they don't need a driver's license. It's the direct supervision.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying if they cross the highway?
Yeah, trying to bring the rules kind of all in a line with, if you're going to be on the highways, mm-hmm. Require a license or that direct supervision.
Thank you.
You bet.
Vice Chair Vial? Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill, in part, would address the issue of non-street legal vehicles using the streets or roads for just incidental use?
Yes.
Okay.
Then there is a companion bill on the Senate side, as we have noted, that is a little bit different. I think we'll be hearing about kind of both approaches to trying to solve this problem as we move forward.
May I respond, ma'am?
Yes, sir. Your name again for the record.
Oh, Ethan Ludwig. Thank you. The one caveat I'd have to say to that is in simply crossing highways, there are many incidents where my family will be out on a ride, which includes a 13-year-old male who's a very competent rider. And if we come to an intersection, we're unable to cross it. This happens all the time in Forest Service roads. Now, while we may be in an OHV park, it's legal to cross that road. But as soon as we step out of the boundaries of, say, a parking lot to get to that OHV area, we technically can't cross the road within 100 feet of an intersection. This bill addresses that problem. Other thing I'd like to say about this bill is that it would create safety corridors that may be parallel, running parallel to pavement. If you've been on the roads in eastern Oregon, they often have a very large shoulder, which may be safe for my 13-year-old male to ride on without requiring a driver's license. And this bill does allow for the committee to make these recommendations that we stay on the shoulder, cross the highway in order to access trail systems. Okay. Does that answer your questions?
And, sir, as one who hails from the South Coast, we have a whole lot of folks who like to ride on sand.
Yeah. As
just,
do I.
Just to be clear. Thank you, gentlemen. We will be revisiting this next week when Representative Barreto gets back, and ODOT will be here to testify on give some input on what they're looking at with this bill. So thank you very much. I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2910. And I think what I would like to do, Tim, is just make sure that we get House Bill 2482 and 2558 moved. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill. Do I have to open a hearing just to roll it over?
No, you can just state that we're going to carry it over.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to move House Bill 2482 and 2458 to March 8th. I do see that we do have an amendment that posted last night. We do not have the paperwork, and I don't believe we have the proponents of this bill here today ready to move this forward, so we're going to move this over to next Wednesday. And that brings us to public hearing on House Bill 2745. And we have a number of people who would like to testify on this bill. I would turn to Mr. Walker to update us on what we're discussing this morning, please.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2745 allows intergovernmental entities with consent of local jurisdictions to levy property taxes for transit services that are tailored to the needs of the individual communities and requires intergovernmental entity to obtain approval of governing bodies in affected cities and counties in the affected territory. We have a dash one amendment, although we are not considering that today.
Okay. Just to make sure that we stay on time, we have a number of people testifying on this House bill. We also have a number of people who want to testify on House Bill 2320. And I think it may be fair to say, Mr. Brower, that we may be constrained with time for an informational hearing on transportation funding today. So I just want to put you on notice that we will do everything we can to do this in a timely manner, but we may end up moving you to Wednesday as well next week. Let's get started with the first three on our list. Mr. Chancellor, Ms. Freend, and Mr. King, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Chancellor, representing the Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council in the city of Bend. I am going to keep my comments brief, mostly because we've had quite a few people travel over from Central Oregon, and they can do better justice to this topic than I can. The Dash 1 amendment to the bill was introduced on our behalf. It does four things. One, it prevents consideration of the authority we're seeking for rail. This is a non-rail bill. Number two, it takes out a reference to transportation districts that would have provided authorities beyond what we were asking for. It wasn't needed. And it also includes two technical fixes recommended by the Department of Revenue and the county assessors. You may note that there is testimony from the county assessors pointing out an interest, declaring neutrality. Our understanding is that those issues have already been addressed in the Dash 1, but we will verify that with them. So just to set the stage for these two, what we're talking about here today in a broad sense is about a new governance model for rural regional transit. We have a tri-county area. We have eight cities of vastly different sizes and shapes. We've struggled with the traditional tools on the table, and we are seeking to innovate a new solution that we believe will work for Central Oregon and potentially is replicable elsewhere in the state. It's an effort on our part to do regional transit, to maintain local control in the process, to ask for your help in allowing us to use our local revenue as much as we can and to develop strong local funding sources and to avoid unnecessary bureaucracy. So with that said, I'll hand it over to Karen and Eric.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Karen Friend, and I'm the Executive Director for Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council, and I'm going to call it COIC. It's just that's the name that we normally go by. So I want to give you a little bit of information about kind of the work leading up to the development of the concept for this bill. COIC is a regional entity, an ORS 190 entity formed by counties and cities. Our board consists of county commissioners and city council members. COIC was asked in 2007 to by community leaders to take transit service in Central Oregon to the next level. The services being provided at the time were really disjointed, inadequate, not well coordinated, and all the agencies providing service at that time recognized that these characteristics were prohibiting more transportation services to their populations as well as the community. So we were asked to step up at, and coordinate with partners across the region to create and fund Cascades East Transit, and did so in 2007. Our Central Oregon community is very interdependent on each other. We travel between communities for jobs and housing and medical services. So that is what drove kind of the creation, the goal to have a regional system. Cascades East Transit has been wildly successful, provided about 673,000 rides last year, and serves 100 miles north to south and 50 miles east to west, connecting eight cities and the tribal community of Warm Springs. And as Eric mentions, cities the size of 500 up to 89,000, and also recreational services to Mount Bachelor. So recognizing the need to plan for the future of the regional transit system, our COIC board formed an advisory committee in 2014 of community leaders to evaluate the best governance model for the transit system, as well as evaluate stable and sustainable funding for the transit system. The community met for several months and in 2004 made recommendations to our board that were as follows. Due to the economies of scale and the intercommunity nature of essential trips, maintain a regionally based transit system with preference for ongoing governance by COIC. Determine if existing ORS 190.083 will allow COIC to levy a property tax for transit operations subject to voter approval, and if not, pursue legislative changes to allow this authority. So COIC developed a concept intended to be on behalf of the cities and counties to accomplish that goal. Local governments wanted us to assure in the concept that we provided full local control for each community to pursue services that met their own community needs. House Bill 2745 reflects those desires and outlines a specific process by which property taxes to support transit operations can be levied for different community-specific zones within its larger service region. Should that legislation pass, and before a property tax levy for transit operations could be levied, all of the following requirements must be satisfied. We must do a pre-resolution with the each city council or the affected city council establishing the terms. Then the governing boards of that affected jurisdiction must pass a resolution consenting to our pre-resolution. Then we must propose a property a ballot measure per the agreed upon terms in the resolution, and then voters must support that. So unless all of these terms are satisfied, there can be no tax. All eight cities within the Cascades East service area support this proposal, most generally because it preserves their local control. In some cases, it allows cities to clearly embrace the prospect of additional transit funding. In others, it allows them to clearly reject it. And yet others allows them to keep their options open for future consideration and to pursue funding if and when they feel the time is right. If approved, COIC will continue to work with willing communities to craft proposals to meet their localized needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric King. I'm the city manager of Bend. And so I want to provide an example of how this model has worked for the city over the last couple of years. Bend was one of the few cities east of the Mississippi River that did not have a fixed route transit system. And so in 2006, we began that journey of establishing a transit system. Simultaneously, COIC developed a regional system looking at serving the more rural communities. We joined forces in 2010 and transferred the service of our fixed route system to COIC. Under this kind of creative model of having some local control and a very different system in a city of 80,000 versus what's happening in the rural communities. And we saw the advantage of connecting that system because of the interconnectedness around jobs and housing that occurs in our region. And so that system puts some local controls and accountability in place. That contract allows us to have authority over changes to service hours or routes. It allows the creation of a public transit advisory committee, a citizen group focused on transit service in the Bend area. So we feel very confident in the ability to take this model and actually formalize it through this legislation. And the challenge for Bend is that we're very fiscally constrained. We've got a tax rate of $2.80 per measures 5 and 50. That rate is frozen. We struggle to provide police, fire, and road maintenance services within our general fund. A solution such as the one being proposed allows us to take the transit dollars out of our general fund, have sustainable funding through a vote of the people in Bend, but connect it to a regional system. And then our intent is to redirect those dollars to much-needed road maintenance. So it provides that kind of creative, innovative approach in leveraging an agency such as COIC versus the traditional transit district model, where it's a very focused, a single-focused entity with its own bureaucracy. And we just feel that why recreate something when we have a structure in place that's been working for the city and really working for the region?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to call up Casey Rhodes, Dennis Scott, and Alan Unger, please. Good morning, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Casey Rhodes. I'm serving as the mayor of Bend. I'm here representing a very politically diverse city council who unanimously supports this concept that you're taking under consideration. And so I won't speak to the specifics of it because I'm a volunteer counselor serving, you know, at the local level. But I can tell you I like the concept. And what I like about the concept is that it really is new and innovative in terms of how we can deliver services in a way that reduces overhead is really the big aim for me personally. And I think it gives me, as someone who has been slow to warming to the idea of funding transit in the Central Oregon area and in Bend in particular, it gives me the confidence to want to move ahead in doing so. One of the things I like about it is that each community can match the level of service to the amount it wants to pay for that service. So rather than having a transit district where people all around Central Oregon would be paying the same rate through their property taxes, it gives communities like Bend the option to enhance their levels of service, whereas members of Crook County or Jefferson County can keep their rate at the levels they think they need. And I think that's important because in Bend currently, one of the things that's tough is we need to reduce our headways, because to have a functioning transit system, you shouldn't be able to walk across town in the same amount of time it takes for the next bus to get there. And that's one of the things that's really important for us is to increase and enhance that level of service. Beyond that, I think it's important that Bend has really become, and more so all the time, the hub for higher education, commercial activities in Central Oregon, healthcare needs that are met. And in particular, I own a small water utility company and operate it in Bend, and our workforce needs the ability to move throughout the region. We have an acute housing shortage, and that is forcing people to not be able to live in the community they work in. And for me personally, I'm willing to help lead an effort in the community to make it easier for people to get to the communities they work in. And until we solve the acute housing crisis, which is, of course, a statewide problem, these transit options give people the opportunity to be upwardly mobile. And I can speak to a particular case where in our small business, we were on the verge of losing a key employee through a series of circumstances beyond her control. She and her family were looking at the very real possibility of having to relocate out of Central Oregon. And if not for the transit system, and those four young women, the mother and three daughters, all high school and college age, they were able to stay in Bend, be upwardly mobile, remain a part of our community and my company. And I actually owe the transit system a great debt of gratitude for that. So on a very personal level, I see the effects of having more options in a better system for getting people to college, to work, letting families share a vehicle or two. It really does make a real world impact. And I think that, again, this governance model that we're talking about today, it has tremendous support both locally, and again, a very politically diverse city council is in support of this, our chambers of commerce, business groups, and I think that what's particularly important for me is that, again, it gives local control and lets the different parts of our region dial in the services they need. And we do need the interconnectedness of a regional transit system, because we are a very regional area that people, thousands and thousands of people, transit from Bend to Redmond and Lapine to Bend and in between the communities. So
thank you.
I'll yield my time to the other members. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, sir.
Well, Dennis Scott, Mayor of Lapine, and I'm representing, I guess, the smaller cities in Central Oregon. We're the newest city in Oregon, and we're only made up of 2,000 people. I mean, there's like another 20,000 maybe within a five-mile radius, but the city of Penn is only 2,000 people. We support this because it is such a different region than what the city of Bend would be. And our population is probably 50% fixed income, retired. Our income base is much lower than Bend. The city was formed to keep the tax rates down. We only have $1.98 per thousand tax base, so we work at really trying to keep our taxes as low as possible. The people of Lapine, you know, we're now in the regional transit hub, which is only like maybe a couple bus rides to Bend, but that suffices for what we need at this point. And it's going to be a long time down the road before we need anything other than that. Mm-hmm. The people of Lapine and the surrounding areas want to see more happening in Lapine, and we're doing that. We have a new grocery store. We're having a medical center built starting this spring, so they won't need as much transit, you know, in the future, any more than we have right now. COIC, Lapine, Deschutes County, you know, they've done a great job making this regional system work the way it is right now, and we're very happy for that. And we need it, but we have enough. And we definitely don't want Lapine taxpayers to be burdened with another tax bill, 'cause Ben may need more transit, where we don't. And I can speak on behalf of all the small cities around, is that it's just unfair for us to have another burden, a tax burden on our citizens. So I encourage, you know, the commission to move forward on this bill, so that the regions can basically do for their citizens what they need to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Chair McEwen and committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Alan Unger. I'm a former Deschutes County Commissioner and former Vice Chair of Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council, our Council of Governments. Why we're here today is we need clarity to the 190 legislation. It talks about how we can collect funds to build infrastructure, but it's not clear on how we could collect funds for operations. And as you've heard about our system and how great it is and how cost-effective it is and efficient, that's what our Council of Government wants to do. It wants to service the needs of our cities and our counties, our local government, as they request to us the need for more operations in the different areas of our region. So what we really need is that clarity, and that's why we've put it in here in this legislation and kind of looked at it as this is really just for us. You know, when you look at being a qualified 190, we put high bars on that qualification. And I want to thank you for the time you came with your Joint Transportation Committee to Central Oregon. We had a good discussion on this then, and you got to see our system, got to ride on our bus, see the challenge we have as you see our communities are 20 miles apart. How do we connect them? How do we connect them with the city of Bend that's 84,000? So thank you for the time. Please consider this request. This will allow us to move forward with the system we have and grow it as each community desires. Thank you.
And Mr. Unger, I want to thank you for your hospitality when we spent a day over in your area with the Joint Committee this summer. It was very enlightening, and you teed up this conversation very nicely for those of us who participated, and it was we were well received, and we're grateful for that.
We tried to do our best, and thank you.
You certainly did. Questions for this panel? All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. Next, I would like to call up Drew Hagedorn, Doug Riggs, and Alan Dinsmore, please. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, members of the committee, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs. I'm here on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We are an almost 20-year-old organization representing 9 cities in 4 counties in Central Oregon, including Deschutes, Jefferson, and also Wasco County. I'm actually going to read a portion of Mayor Royce Embank's testimony. He's our COCO chair and is the mayor of Madras, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. As you well know, Central Oregon has been one of the fastest-growing areas in the state for many years. With growth comes challenges. Rents and housing values go up, forcing low-wage workers further out from city centers and into neighboring communities. Traffic congestion increases, and anyone who's been in and out of Bend in rush hour certainly understands this in the last few years. And workers who live in one city, for instance, Madras, might actually find employment in Bend or Lapine or maybe even Prineville. So we're becoming a very transient area as far as our workforce. All of this is leading the cities, counties, and business organizations in the region to try to think long-term and plan for a way to ensure that we maintain mobility for our workforce, students, and seniors in the region. In looking at this system, we have 3 choices about the ways to accomplish this. The first would be to allow each city or county to form a separate system with a separate administrative bureaucracy, separate buses, and separate maintenance crews and employees, and separate funding mechanisms. The second choice would be to form a new special district or transit district that would cover the entire region. This would create a brand new transportation system that would create a one-size-fits-all model based on state law and a universal single-rate mechanism for funding that would fall equally on all the people in the region. And the third, which is what we're here to talk about today, is to utilize an existing organization with an existing board of local city, county, and business leaders and give it the ability to offer each community transit in a way that best fits their needs and is tailored to the wishes of each particular city. Choice number 3 is what we're trying to accomplish with this bill and with the forthcoming amendments. It is, in our view, absolutely the only option that makes any sense whatsoever. As Eric mentioned earlier, this bill really is about a governance model. It protects the rights of individual cities and their individual voters to decide by themselves what size, type, and cost of transit model works or does not work for them. The effort preserves the real decision-making authority with the citizens of each city. No city would be required or compelled to implement transit at any particular time. No voters would have any revenue source forced upon them, and no decisions would be made before the local cities had public hearings, public notices, a full debate, and the opportunity for local citizens to weigh in. In summary, this approach avoids creation of another potentially inefficient, costly bureaucracy, which would have to be started from scratch. This model allows us to take advantage of existing resources to get the job done. That's just plain smart and plain common sense. We certainly urge your support for this bill and look forward to working with you in the coming weeks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative McLean. To your testimony, the only question that I have, because everything else sounds like it's kumbaya, but does it allow, does it, a transit district, or does the kind of what you're calling a regional government model, are there any differences as far as what resources they can actually, you know, assess, like grants, or, you know, look at federal or state? Are they going to be treated in the same way?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, I would probably defer to the experts on that, but based on my understanding, COIC currently applies for and receives grants and federal funding and the like, would continue to be allowed to do so. I think the real benefit of this is, if I am a councilor in Prineville or a citizen in Prineville, my timeline and my need for transit is quite different than Ben's. And so if we formed a single transit district under current law, that would be required to levy an equal tax.
Yeah.
This approach, the benefit is it allows us all to go kind of on a different timeline to take advantage of existing resources so we don't have new bureaucracies, but also on that rate issue to be able to determine what rate makes sense for them. So it might be a different rate in Redmond than Bend or Madras than Prineville.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Al Densmore. I am with JWA Public Affairs here representing the Rogue Valley Transportation District, its Executive Director Julie Brown and board. And just briefly to say that we applaud the Central Oregon region and its creativity in this approach, its flexibility. And though I haven't had a chance to discuss this issue with our client in the past, I know that our district has sought to serve the city of Eagle Point in its transit needs and has become high-centered on the different need in that particular community. And I am, for one, anxious if this bill becomes law to explore whether or not it might serve as some way of connecting our transit district with the city of Eagle Point in some way under Section 190. So again, applaud the creativity and flexibility and hope that you'll consider the bill favorably.
Well, and Mr. Densmore, I applaud what's happened down in the Rogue Valley in bringing people together to support your transit system in an also a very creative way. So you, in essence, led the charge on some of these conversations in the work that you that has been done by your client down south. So I applaud them.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair McCune, committee members. I'm Drew Hagedorn, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Transit Association, testifying in support of House Bill 2745. I think this legislation is an innovative approach to address a problem that transit agencies throughout our state have, which is how do I identify sources of revenue for operations? This also hits, I think, some key metrics, Madam Chair, that we're talking about in the work group on transit and on roadway of your joint committee, which would be to connect communities, as we've heard from a number of folks, and also provide access from affordable housing to goods and services and employment opportunities. And so I think this hits just the perfect mix for this community. We laud the proponents for bringing this forward and wanted to express our strong support. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you for being here this morning. That exhausts my witness registration list. Is there anyone else who would like to comment now that you've had a chance to hear a little bit more about this? Mr. Chancellor? And we'll move on.
Again, for the record, Eric Chancellor, City of Bend, COIC. I believe that there may still be some folks in transit from Central Oregon. Obviously, if they're not here in time, then they won't get the opportunity to testify. I don't know, based on how the committee is scheduled today, whether if they do show up, there might be an opportunity to allow them to speak.
Sir, if they have traveled over 100 miles, we will do everything in our power to make sure they have an opportunity to speak, as long as it's before 9:45. So, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So I'm going to close the – where are we? Let's see. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2745, and I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2320. And Mr. Walker, get us up to speed, please.
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2320 establishes the non-motorized boating program within the Oregon State Marine Board with funding provided by non-motorized boating permits. In addition, it requires persons using non-motorized craft on river or stream to wear life jackets. This bill is in response to a budget note from the 2015 Legislative Assembly to continue public outreach to non-motorized boaters with respect to a methodology for licensing non-motorized boats, and return to the 2017 Legislative Assembly with a formal proposal and a legislative concept for implementation of the fee.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. We have a number of people who would like to testify. I would just comment that this concept came before this Transportation Committee in the prior session. We had conversations about it, hence the budget note. So this is not a new concept. It's been out there for a while, and now we have a bill before us. And I'd like to start out by calling up Director Bruin, Aaron, it looks like Zettler. I'm not going to get this correct. So I'm going to let you say your own name when you come up here. And Clinton Bagley, please. Thank you for being here this morning, sir.
Good morning, Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Meek, Vice Chair Weil, members of the committee. For the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. Pleasure to be with you this morning to talk about House Bill 2320. So House Bill 2320 addresses issues identified in the Marine Board's 2011 strategic plan. The program is a result of 4 years of work with two non-motorized advisory committees and feedback from an online survey and 13 public meetings around the state. The external advisory committee was comprised of 14 members who represented a geographically diverse mixture of boaters who enjoy kayaking, canoeing, stand-up paddling, rafting, drift boating, and rowing on Oregon's waterways. What you see here is the 2011 statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan survey conducted by Oregon State Parks. This survey represents user days on the water. So one kayaker in a boat for one day is one user day. Four boaters on a recreational boat is four user days. So that's how the survey was conducted. I don't know if I can show. So this line right here is non-motorized boating. This right here is motorized. This line is board sailing, and this one is sailing. So you can see the survey shows growth in both motorized and non-motorized activity. Although the non-motorized activity in 2011 actually exceeded motorized and is on a faster trajectory for growth. Similarly, in 2015, a special report by the Outdoor Foundation reports a 21.9% increase in canoers, kayakers, and stand-up paddleboarders nationally from 2008 to 2014. Oregon has likely seen similar numbers, if not greater, while simultaneously seeing an 11% decrease in the number of registered boats. So this growth is well known by boating facility providers. The available single-car parking at boating access facility is minimal, with many vehicles using trailer-only parking spaces, denying the space for intended use of trailered boats, and in some cases being ticketed for parking illegally. If you look at this picture at the bottom left, those are trailer parking spaces that are being used by single vehicles. Similarly, launch ramps and boarding floats that are designed for motorized boats are being used to stage paddlecraft prior to launching. Concrete boat ramps and high freeboard docks are not the preferred launching area for paddlecraft, but in many locations there are very few safe alternatives for accessing the water. Additionally, restroom locations are built at motorized launch ramps. Consequently, those floating rivers are either packing out their waste or they are using public or private land for that purpose. Trespassing above the high water line onto private land for that purpose is illegal. House Bill 2320 addresses the issue with lack of access, lack of adequate parking, and inadequate launch areas by establishing a non-motorized boating access program. The Marine Board may provide grants to assist public agencies with the purchase of land, leases, or easements in order to create access to waterways, and grants for construction, renovation, expansion, or development of non-motorized boating facilities, whitewater parks, and competition courses. So this picture is of the hole in the wall in the Clackamas River. The Marine Board provided a small amount of funding to support this whitewater access. You can see there's a carry down area with a slide for kayaks, as well as a launch area with sand or gravel for folks to access the water. The funds may also be used to modify or upgrade existing motorized boating facilities to accommodate or incorporate non-motorized boating carry down access to sand or gravel beaches or low freeboard docks. Funds may also be used to provide technical services to public agencies and maintenance and assistance program funding for upkeep of those facilities. This is a picture of Max Canyon. We completed this project this past year. On the bottom is the new launch ramp that we put in, and you can see to the side is where you can access with non-motorized boats. So it's an example of a mixed-use facility. This chart is of our boating fatalities from 1997 to 2016, broken out in blue as our motorized fatalities and in red our non-motorized fatalities. The Marine Board contracts with 32 county sheriffs and the state police for law enforcement services on our waters. That money is paid for by motorized boating fees and federal funds. Law enforcement officers in many counties report spending more than half of their on-water time addressing safety issues involving non-motorized boaters. On average, approximately 50% of boater deaths on Oregon waterways are non-motorized boaters, as you can see in this diagram. House Bill 2320 addresses the increased demands placed on law enforcement by establishing a non-motorized boating safety education program. The Marine Board may contract for patrols in areas with significant non-motorized presence and purchase appropriate watercraft to assist in enforcement. In some cases, this will be increased patrols in areas with significant motorized and non-motorized activities where user conflicts and safety concerns have been identified. In other areas, it will be in support of seasonally significant non-motorized activities or events which heavily tax local sheriff's offices. The bill also allows additional funding for the removal of obstructions that create a significant hazard to navigation, such as these pictured. In a recent report issued by the National Transportation Safety Board titled Shared Waterways, Safety of Recreational and Commercial Vessels in Marine Transportation System, the NTSB recognized the lack of education by recreational boaters and in its recommendation asked the Coast Guard to seek authority to require all recreational boats, boat operators demonstrate completion of a course that meets national standards. This report came after an incident in New York in August of this year with kayakers on a guided trip that went behind a ferry and the ferry backed into them. The guide attempted to contact the ferry by waving his arm, but because of the sunset behind him, the ferry operator could not see the kayak group. Nobody died in the incident. They were able to pull them out, but they recognized the growth that is occurring. And in this case, everybody's required to have an efficient means of producing sound. Someone trained should understand that in that kind of a situation, they should sound a danger signal. Yet the person guiding the trip did not know that and instead used his arms, which were not visible by the ferry operator. So, Oregon has a motorized boating course that meets national standards, but no such standards exist in Oregon for non-motorized boats. The Marine Board does publicize an online paddle sport course, but the other options are through clubs, nonprofit organizations, or vendors. House Bill 2320 addresses educational concerns, although it stops short of mandating education, and directs the Marine Board to establish a voluntary non-motorized boating education program. So the bill directs the Marine Board to set minimum standards, design courses and examinations for classroom and on-water competency for beginning boaters, and may provide grants to nonprofit organizations to provide the training. The bill also requires the Marine Board to develop minimum education standards for livery operators. So committee members discussed safety at great length and felt life jacket wear would remedy the amount of time law enforcement spends on the water ensuring safety of people using swimming pool float toys, air mattresses, and inner tubes on certain rivers and streams. To attempt to improve the safety, House Bill 2320 defines a non-motorized craft as an object not propelled by machinery or defined as a boat, capable of supporting a person on the water. The bill as written requires life jacket wear when operated, non-motorized craft is operated on rivers or streams. Operators of non-motorized craft would not be required to purchase a permit under this program. So the intent of the committee was to require life jacket wear on segments of rivers and streams as designated by the board and rule, but this differs from the current bill language. A number of different options have been raised for addressing this discrepancy, and the Marine Board is open to discussing an amendment. This bill makes no changes to life jacket requirements for boats, including kayaks, canoes, and stand-up paddle boards. This picture, the two top pictures are of the same riffle on the Clackamas River. The one on the left, the person on the inflatable orca, the current pushed him into the center of the channel, so he didn't have any problems. Neither of these are maneuverable on their own. The other top right, you may not be able to see, but that person's on an inner tube, and the current pulled that person into a bunch of tree limbs hanging over the water. Interestingly enough, those tree limbs were trimmed the day before by the sheriff's office. They came through and trimmed that area. Otherwise, he would have been stuck underneath those and could have had some pretty horrific issues came up. As it was, the inner tube flipped. The inner tube continued down the river, and he was actually saved by his beer cooler that he grabbed onto and floated down on the beer cooler until he could get to his into his inner tube that was further down. So when we're talking about these sorts of things, that's kind of what we're talking about, is the lack of maneuverability of those craft, and then if you fall out of them, your flotation goes away. So House Bill 2320 requires a non-motorized boating permit be carried on all boats, regardless of lengths, for all persons 14 years of age and older. The permit is transferable person to person and boat to boat and can be combined into a single permit with the AIS permit, the Aquatic Invasive Species permit. Livery boats are exempt from carrying the permit if they are properly marked. The permit does not apply on federally designated wild and scenic rivers where a fee system is in place. For boats engaged in law enforcement, public safety, or official business of a federal, state, or municipal agency, as defined in rule, boats launched from a border state onto border waters, and for operators holding a non-motorized boating permit, registration, or similar authorization issued by another state and accepted by the board by rule. Fees for this program are deposited in a dedicated fund to support this program. The fees were established with the External Advisory Committee to be as low as possible, yet raise enough money to provide tangible services to non-motorized boaters. The established fee structure, based on the estimated number of permits sold, will provide approximately $1 million per biennium for boating access grants, $300,000 per biennium in boating safety services, $100,000 per biennium for education grants and for debris removal. The program will also fund a position to coordinate the program, a position to provide boating facility technical assistance, and a half-time position to process permits. The Marine Board partnered with the Oregon State Parks on their statewide recreational trails plan titled Oregon Trails 2016, A Vision for the Future. One of the questions asked in the survey for non-motorized boaters was, would you oppose or support an annual fee? They gave them options of an annual fee of $10, $15, and $20 that would be required for all non-motorized boats, regardless of length, and would be transferable across boats. At the level of $15 per year, which is the level of a two-year permit inclusive of AIS, 59% either strongly or somewhat supported the fee, 33% were either strongly or somewhat opposed, and 8% were right in the middle, neither opposed or support. So the 20 In 2015, the Marine Board received this budget note, which has already been brought up. The legislature recognized the issue and the disparity between motorized and non-motorized users, but understood that Marine Board was working with boaters to establish a program that would benefit them. This has become House Bill 2320. In closing, non-motorized boating popularity is anticipated to continue to rise, and their needs for access, safety services, and education will similarly follow, making the current model unsustainable into the future. House Bill 2320 was developed with non-motorized boaters to serve the needs of non-motorized boaters. It is respectfully submitted for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer your questions. Thanks.
Thank you. I think we'll go ahead and any questions for the director before we move on to testimony? Representative Noble?
I do have a question. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Trying to grasp this, most of the accesses I use to get access to river are maintained and developed by counties or cities. Have they been involved in this discussion at all as far as resources to get watercraft onto the water?
Chairman Kuhn, Representative Noble, yes, they have, and in fact, there are some folks here to testify on that behalf on the part of Oregon Parks. We've worked with them, and in fact, a lot of the desire for this program came from parks managers who were getting so many requests for non-motorized access, or they're just dealing with overcrowding at launch ramps because A, folks are parked in that trailer parking with single cars, or just the use of the restrooms and trash cans and everything is overwhelming in some areas.
I've had that experience.
Yes, Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Just two questions. One is, what was the rationale for linking the fee increases for development, et cetera, and the life preservers for this new category of boats? And secondly, aren't there some categories currently where it's up to 18 as opposed to having to wear in current boats being used out there? Like, for example, fishing boats, you have to have one available, but you don't necessarily have to be wearing it.
Right.
Can you explain that?
So, Chair McKeown, Representative Evans, the first piece with regard to non-motorized craft, that arose in our discussion about education, and the committee was very concerned about folks in pool toys out on the water, and the amount of law enforcement time spent with folks and the litter from these pool toys when they hit a branch or something and then they pop and they're left on the waterways. The desire of the committee was to try to make them boats and try to expand our definition of a boat and make it more inclusive. The problem is that wouldn't be in compliance with what the Coast Guard defines as a boat, mm-hmm. which would put us out of compliance under federal law, which is a problem for a number of different reasons, including the fact that we have an agreement with them that says we will mirror federal law. For boats under 13 are required to wear a life jacket. You're also required to wear a life jacket if you're in Class 3 Rapids or above. It's a current requirement on boats. So this would be a requirement specific to these non-motorized craft.
But only in those follow up.
Yes, sir.
But only in those rapids environments, not anywhere else?
Well, the intent of the committee was to look at areas that we were specifically petitioned to deal with. The Clackamas River is a good example where the county has been trying to deal with the issue of non-motorized craft and the impact on the waterways. The impact on law enforcement having to work in that area where there is some minor whitewater. You generally aren't getting these craft on bigger whitewater, but certainly on small riffles, Class 1, Class 2 maybe. However, the way the bill was drafted, it's all areas. That was really not our intent to go into all areas.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about what a boat livery is. And the reason I ask that is a number of young people in my community, 14 and over, go to gas stations and rent what we call Tahitis or kayaks in the afternoon to go down to the river. My question is, does this class of individual need the non-motorized boating permit, or is the gas station a livery, and as a result of being classified a livery, that doesn't apply to them?
Chair McKeown, Representative Wilson, the gas station, if they're renting boats, something that would be classified as a boat would be considered a boat livery and would be able to pay the fees for the liveries, which are different. They're based on the number of boats that they rent. They would pay a set fee, and they would be able to mark their boats. Therefore, the user would not have to pay a fee or would not have to buy a permit if they're using those livery-rented boats. So it's to their advantage for someone that's renting boats to call themselves a livery, and they would get the reduced fee in order to rent those boats. But they would have the additional responsibility of needing to do some basic education with folks of what they're getting into. And part of this bill asks us to work with those with livery providers to establish some basic education for those that are renting boats so people aren't going out without any knowledge whatsoever of what they're doing.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Noble.
And I thank you. I know we're short on time. I have a question about permits. If I have a license already because time caught up with me and I had to go ahead and get my license to operate my motorized boat, would I also need then a permit for non-motorized since I've gone through the education of boating and...
Yeah, Chair McCune, Representative Noble, the way the law is currently written is you would have to have a permit for your non-motorized boats, but you could transfer that permit boat to boat along there. But having motorized registration wouldn't exempt you from the non-motorized requirement.
Different than the boat, different than the boat registration. The actual my license to operate my boat, my personal license from the Marine Board that says that I am capable of operating.
Provided you aren't titling a non-motorized boat, because you can title a non-motorized boat in this state, and then you would be exempt from this requirement, but your registration and your title for your motorized boat would not exempt you from this requirement.
Thank you.
Just to clarify, as the owner of an aluminum jet boat, a number of inflatable kayaks, and an 11-foot paddleboard, I would have to have, I could buy a permit for my 11-foot paddleboard with the invasive species endorsement as well, and I could then use that when I get in my inflatable and want to go down a stream or a river.
Chair McCune, that's correct.
And if I take my two children and we have three kayaks, I need three permits, one for each of those non-motorized boats that they are using.
Unless correct? They're under 14.
Which they're not.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Vile.
Chair McKeon. Similar question to what the chair just asked. So I've got a farm 2.5 miles of river frontage. A bunch of kids, bunch of grandkids, many of them under 14. We've got probably 10 kayaks out there on the farm. Grandpa takes 3 grandkids out, all under 14. Got them on there. We got them with their life jackets on. They're each in their own kayak. How many permits do I have to buy?
Chair McCune, Vice Chair Vile, by the sounds of what you just told me, just the one for the individual over 14. The others would not be required to have a permit.
So the 4 grandkids that are under 14, each in their own kayak, I don't need a kayak. I don't need a license on that boat or on the kid.
No.
But just to clarify, sir, do they need an invasive species permit for those?
Chair McKeown, no. We have a bill in right now for our AIS program that puts into statute that AIS permit is only required for those 14 and older. Okay. We have that in rule right now, but statute doesn't. It's a little bit muddy in statute, so we want to make sure that that is in statute. But as long as they're under 14, they don't require either.
Thank you for clarifying that. I think it's an important point. We have a number of people still wanting to testify, so what I would like to do is, please, gentlemen, your testimony is very welcome here today, but if you could keep it as brief as possible. Then we're going to adjourn and go back to House Bill 2320 briefly, and then we'll come back. So.
Great. Good morning. First of all, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for letting me testify. I want to contextualize some of the feedback that I've heard and will be communicating. I represent, well, let me correct that.
Your name for the record, sir.
My first name is Clinton. My last name is Begley.
Thank you.
I serve on the board for the Willamette Kayak and Canoe Club, also on the board for the Cascadia Wave down in Eugene, Oregon. I live in Springfield. I'm a member of American Whitewater and American Rivers, but my testimony today is my own and as a private citizen. So I don't believe that whitewater kayaking was accurately or fully represented in the presentation we just saw, and so I seek to add context to some of the objection to this bill, and I'll just read a short statement. The majority of my 108 days on the water last year involved travel of one or more hours each way, at least one gas station stop and likely a meal stop. As an experienced paddler, the majority of my paddling occurs high in the watershed, in rural areas, and near local economies. My experience is not atypical among kayakers, and these contributions to the service economy are significant. The typical whitewater kayaker has invested upwards of $1,000 in personal safety equipment like helmets, PFDs, whistles, throw ropes, river knives, float bags, boat retrieval equipment, and dry gear. These help to create a safe atmosphere for ourselves and others on the river. Many have likely spent around $400 to $600 for a multi-day swiftwater rescue class and wilderness first aid to learn the techniques necessary to keep themselves and others safe on the river. This is in addition to membership dues to organizations like American Whitewater, American Rivers, the American Canoe Association that each promote access, beneficial environmental conditions, and river safety, plus membership in local and regional clubs like the Willamette Kayak and Canoe Club that promote and support beginner classes and open access to those new to the sport in our area. Many boaters volunteer for these organizations on river cleanups, safety training weekends, introductory classes, and as board members guiding their activities. Kayakers are also typically very supportive of publicly funded state and federal programs allocating government funds towards issues of access and safety. The local government grant program, the Federal Highway Administration's Recreational Trails Program, the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and the U.S. Coast Guard, to name a few, have all contributed towards either stewardship, access, or safety. In other words, most kayakers do not have a fundamental objection to the appropriation of public funds in support of safety and access for non-motorized recreationists, and many resources already exist in support of those users and receive our support. Within that context, it should be clear that objection to House Bill 2320 is not reflective of an unwillingness by kayakers to pay their fair share for safety and access. It is an objection to the idea that the proposed activities are either fair or our share. The user group benefiting from proposed activities is not being asked to pay the fee. That would be the non-motorized craft. Paddlers are not the target user group, and the fee would seek to serve through the Marine Board's activities. The primary target of the proposed activities appears to be the users of inner tube and other non-boat inflatable craft, and yet these users would not be subject to the proposed fee. In effect, paddle sports community is being asked to subsidize a user group with different motivations, expectations, level of engagement, economic impact, and most importantly, approach to safety. As written, I'm unconvinced that the proposal is the best mechanism through which to address the issues of safety and access generally, as other entities and mechanisms I've mentioned are already in place and well-equipped to conduct this work on an educational rather than regulatory basis. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the proposal ignores the significant investment of energy, time, money, of paddle sports enthusiasts to voluntarily build a community of practice around safety and mutual support in favor of a narrow regulatory approach that disproportionately negatively impacts them without a clear benefit to our highly engaged and proactive user group.
Please, I finished.
I am.
Great, thank you. We have a number of people testifying. If you have written testimony and you've submitted it, if you could summarize it when you come up, I'd be very grateful. Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Aaron Zettler-Mann. I'm also a kayaker, non-motorized boat user, and as well, I'm a doctoral candidate at the University of Oregon, where I study river landscape, human interactions. And I'm here to voice my opposition as well to House Bill 2320 on the grounds that it doesn't equitably assess fees to the users and those that are the proposed beneficiaries of the spending of the fees. The law makes no guarantee that the fees would be used to the benefit of non-motorized boaters, and I'm referring here to the use of the term may, page 3, lines 20 to 32. HB 2320 assesses fees on the non-motorized users of Oregon waterways indiscriminately based on potential use anywhere within the state. I draw the analogy to a fee for a hiking boot fee that would be levied on the users of all or the owners of hiking boots to fund education for something like not getting lost. within that framework, we have a blanket fee structure would be unacceptable to a large percentage of the population, and it seems silly that waterways would be treated differently than hiking trails. And in fact, an existing framework for hiking exists, whereby fees are paid at use areas. Higher use areas have higher fees associated with them, and low use and rural areas have smaller or no fees. Expanding the existing parking and day use fee structure at waterway access points would better be suited to enhancing revenue for the Oregon State Marine Board, as the users of the most heavily trafficked points would pay for the upkeep and maintenance of those locations. In addition, the educational material could be posted at these high traffic, high conflict locations. I would add that the photos from the non-motorized craft slide and boating safety enforcement slide, the clear educational targets for this bill, are excluded from the fee structure proposed in the bill. To the sort of paying our own fair share point, non-motorized boaters make many financial and voluntary contributions to the state of Oregon. We purchase fuel, pay parking fees, support local, often rural businesses. We donate time and money to local nonprofits working to protect and improve access to Oregon state waters through organizations such as American Whitewater and the Willamette Kayak and Canoe Club. We volunteer to teach water safety across the state through a number of volunteer organizations. Non-motorized boaters contribute in many ways to the broader community, and special fees will do nothing to enhance the experience of current users, will undermine our current voluntary contributions, and may discourage new users who do not want to have to pay to play on public waterways. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. I'd like to call up next. Actually, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2320, reopen the hearing on House Bill 2745, and invite Mr. D-O-R-O-T, it looks like, and Mr. Ross for... Gentlemen, and we're happy to have you here today to comment. If you could keep it as brief as possible, we would be grateful.
My name is James DeRofi. I'm the board chair of the Old Farm District Neighborhood Association in Bend, Oregon. I'm here in support of 2745. Due to a verbal gaffe, the last time I talked with you guys in regards to transportation needs of Bend, decided to not do any prepared remarks and just speak from the heart.
Thank you.
I represent approximately 4,000 doors in Bend. Currently, we have public transportation that basically borders our neighborhood association, and we need more, and we need stable funding for that to occur. As Bend continues to grow and we have more homes that are getting built, we need the ability for someone such as myself who doesn't drive to go to the grocery store to be able to get to work. And in order for this to occur, we need not just other transportation to get funded, and but we need the ability to have the ability to do that in the city's hands, and I mean outside of the state's control. I'm not going to talk long. That's it. Like I said, this is support, and we have 4,000 plus people that are for this type of control, and we want more.
Sir, we appreciate your testimony today. Thank you for being here. Welcome, sir.
Richard Ross. I'm a Bend resident, and I'm the chair of Cascades East Regional Public Transit Advisory Committee, and I have 23 years of experience or more in transportation planning in the Portland metro area. I want to say this morning to start off just by thanking the committee for their attention to Central Oregon's issues, and particularly to Chair McCune and Representative McLean, who were in Bend last summer for the magical tour, the legislative tour of the Joint Committee. I've never seen anything quite like that. We like to just tour Oregon in the summertime, but I believe the committee took at least 14 stops all over the state, and Bend residents really appreciated the listening sessions that went on in August. So, but not to brag about our region, as you probably have heard, that Cascades East Transit is the largest transit provider in the state without a dedicated source of funds. And yet, it's serving two of the state's fastest growing counties, Deschutes and Crook County. We're in the running with Washington County, and I'm not sure that's always the best running to be in. However, as you know, the Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council is a unique type of structure in Oregon. I think you've heard some things about that, so I won't go into it. But the critical thing for Bend, for its future, that's happening right now, is Bend is becoming a university town with a huge state investment in OSU Cascades. And we need a transit investment that goes along with that so that students can get to school and our workforce can get to their jobs without clogging up the highways in Bend and the regional choke points as well. So I think those are probably the critical things to consider here. And we need to have that financial power in the hands of residents of the region, as this bill provides. So thank you very much for your attention and hard work.
And, sir, thank you again for your hospitality this summer on behalf of the Joint Committee. We appreciate it very much. It was a great day. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, for making the trip. I'm going to, again, get my numbers right. Close the hearing on House Bill 2745, reopen the hearing on House Bill 2320, and we will continue by calling Marcel Biey, it looks like, Steve Lambert, and Mike Russell, please. And gentlemen, as briefly as you can keep your comments, I would be grateful. We still have a couple of more panels after you, so. Thank you for being here this morning.
I'll take it from here.
Good morning.
Jeremy McEwen, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. I'll keep my comments very brief. I prepared a speech, but we'll leave it at that. I'm here to represent the Oregon Parks Association.
And your name, sir?
Steve Lambert.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm here to represent the Oregon Parks Association, and I am currently the parks manager for Jackson County Parks as well. There was a comment from Representative Noble regarding the input from facility managers in this process, and I would like to go on the record as to say that the State Marine Board has been extremely inclusive of all the users and facility providers, law enforcement along this process, and held several committee meetings and sought public input along the way. They are a tremendous organization to work with. We work with several federal, state partners in our delivering the services that we provide, and I can't say enough about the public input and the partnership from the State Marine Board. If there is one agency in the state of Oregon that can deliver this program, I am fully confident that the State Marine Board will be able to do that. There is a need for this type of program. We see it every day out in our parks, and we would love the committee to provide support for this bill.
Thank you, sir, for being here this morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair, Committee. My name is Mike Russell. I'm also here representing Oregon Parks Association, and I'm also the Director of Parks for Lane County. Similar to Steve, we see this issue every year, and it seems to be growing, as depicted by the information that you saw earlier. Again, I want to also reiterate that the partnership with the Oregon State Marine Board over the last however long on motorized boating has been exceptional. Realizing what they bring to the table is expertise, state-of-the-art advice, and support for our boating facilities. And I agree with Steve that if any agency could deliver on this, it would be them. As far as non-motorized boating, in Lane County, we have over half of our 70 park system has some type of access to water. And so we are constantly seeing the use of access, particularly for non-motorized boaters at motorized boating facilities and those conflicts that can occur. And appreciate the Oregon State Marine Board attempting to address those issues through this bill. I encourage your support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today. My name is Marcel Beig. I work for the American Canoe Association, which is pretty much the largest nonprofit that has to do with paddle sports education in the country. We're not based in the West. It's our head office is in Fredericksburg. However, I'm the only Western supporter or the Western employee out here. We're neutral on this issue because of our status. We work in federal areas and federal law. However, what I did want to just mention today, I have been part of this process in the more recent time once I moved to Oregon, and I have to commend the Marine Board on the groups that they accessed and the people that came into this whole process. The ACA doesn't stand on a state level. You know, we leave that up to the state and the groups, but we do encourage the process of bringing all the different user groups to the table to make that happen, and the Marine Board has done an excellent job with that, and the working groups have really taken some of that into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Isle.
Chair McKeown, I think probably my question doesn't matter, but Steve, let's start with you. So as I understand it, we've got probably county-financed boat launch areas, correct, that you're dealing with, and we've got the Marine Board running a program. Do they collect money from the boaters that use those facilities that comes back to you?
Chair McKeown, Representative Vile, it's a mix. So I'll keep it very brief for you on your timeline. As counties have seen revenues declining for parks and recreation purposes, we have been forced across the state to start charging parking fees for maintenance of our facilities. So part of our revenue comes from the parking fees that we charge that stays within the county to maintain our own county parks. We also are supplemented by facility grants, capital grants from the Oregon State Marine Board with that has a 25% match requirement that we can match to do capital improvements to build new facilities or maintain our current facilities. We also receive operational assistance from the State Marine Board through the Maintenance Assistance Program, a portion of marine gas tax revenues that come to counties to help maintain and operate those facilities. So it's a mixture of state and local funds that are being used to maintain current boating facilities across the state. And I would also reiterate what Director Bruin mentioned, that these are funds coming from the titling and registration of motorboats and gas tax revenues.
Follow up,
yes,
Madam Chair.
Admittedly,
I was a bit intrigued when I heard the testimony earlier that maybe the solution to this was fees for the parking at the facilities rather than attempting to license inner tubes. And I'm wondering, even though that might change the financing element for the facilities that you're managing, is that something that you've seriously considered?
Chair McKeown, Representative Vile, we currently charge. Again, I want to make it very clear on the record, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Parks Association, not Jackson County, but in Jackson County, as an example, we currently charge a $4 parking fee for all of our parks, including the boat ramps along the Rogue or at some of the lakes. That $4 parking fee is not enough to maintain and operate adequately the boating facilities that we have. So that fee would have to be substantially more than $4, which I'm sure many constituents wouldn't want to pay either.
Thank you.
Any questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Lori, looks like Pavey, Priscilla, and Elizabeth. I'm having trouble reading. It looks like Steiner, possibly. Oh, she already, I'm sorry. This is Senator Steiner Hayward, who's already testified. I'm having trouble with people's handwriting here. Priscilla, it looks like Macy. Is that correct? Did I get it close?
You got it.
Ladies, welcome to our committee this morning. We thank you for being here.
Chairman McKeown and members
it's
of the committee.
It's McKeown, thank
McKeown,
you.
McKeown, I'm sorry.
Happens all the time. You get a pass.
I've done it myself, just so you know.
My name is Lori Pavey. I'm from Corvallis, and this is my first time ever being at a testimony.
We're so happy to have you here this morning.
Mm-hmm. I've been a paddler in Oregon for over 40 years, mostly whitewater rivers, and I do not... I offer the following reasons for not supporting a non-motorized boating permit. Canoes and kayaks have been freely floated on Oregon's rivers since Lewis and Clark first paddled in Oregon, and we should not have to pay a fee to merely dip our paddles in the water, which is what this permit would be. The Marine Board states that many non-motorized boaters demand more facilities and education, but the user groups that I paddle with, we do not need or want any developed facilities. We shoulder our kayaks. We walk down a trail to the river. No boat ramp is needed. And yet under this bill, we would need to pay yearly fees for services and facilities that we do not need nor want. Under the proposed legislation, a family of four people, two teenagers, two adults, would need to pay $76 per year with all of the fees that aquatic species and the permit paddle and the agent fees. $76 per year just to paddle their canoes a couple of times on Oregon lakes. These fees would be in addition to any parking fees that they would have to pay or Forest Service parking passes. Thus, many families, especially those of lower income, might find it difficult to access Oregon's waters. I'm concerned with the practicality of enforcement of this law, and I predict that any revenue generated would be very quickly consumed by skyrocketing costs of enforcement. The sheriffs would be very, very busy checking everyone's paddling permit. Traditionally, 62% of the Marine Board's budget has been used for law enforcement and administration. Thus, the amount left over for facility maintenance and improvement is marginal. I think it's time for the Marine Board to scale back their operations, tighten their belt, and downsize. Just because they're losing revenue from declining powerboat fees, they should not start a whole new program to tax a whole new set of watercraft in an effort to increase their revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And thank you so much for your testimony this morning.
Good morning. Honorable Chairwoman, Honorable Committee members, my name is Priscilla Macy, and I'm testifying as a private citizen. I'm a lifelong whitewater enthusiast, have a bachelor's degree in recreation resource management. I'm currently a graduate student in the College of Business, and I'm a resident of Albany, Oregon. It's pretty close. I'm representing myself and my boyfriend, Jacob, who are both whitewater enthusiasts. I've also in the past been an educator for whitewater safety through Oregon State University. We oppose House Bill 2320 for the following reasons. I have spent time sitting as a student in the non-motorized advisory committee meetings, so I've been involved in this process for a number of years and have been following it closely, so it's interesting to see how it's developed. I oppose House Bill 2320 because as a whitewater enthusiast, we wear life jackets every time we go in the water, and we don't want to directly support a $2 million program that's focused on requiring non-boat or the inner tuber type crafts being enforced to wear life jackets when they are not required to pay fees, but the non-motorized boaters with paddles would be required to subsidize for. We do not believe that based on the text that the Marine Board put on their website, considering a waterway, a highway with lanes of traffic, to be putting enough effort into understanding how traffic works on rivers. Most whitewater users and flatwater users would consider rivers more of a trail versus a highway with lanes. While a $12 annual cost is pretty modest, the hassles of securing another permit and to recreate results in additional barriers to getting outside groups to enjoy outdoor recreation. And this will further discourage others from visiting our state, which is a large source of revenue, and for partaking in non-motorized boating. That's my quick version. So thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you so much for your work on this.
Ladies, thank you so much for being here. Are there questions for this panel? My ladies, thank you so much. Next, I would like to call up, let's see, I have Ben Corrado, or Serrato, not quite sure. There. And Ron Hilbert, please.
Madam Chairwoman, representatives of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. I'm Ben Corrado. I am a Huron as a private citizen. I am a member of the Oregon Whitewater Association and a board member for them, as well as of the American Whitewater Association. I oppose House Bill 2320. Looking at the respondents from the survey that was sent out, 0% strongly agreed with the statement that they felt the Marine Board could effectively represent paddle sports, and 0% strongly agreed with the statement that the Marine Board understands the need of the paddle sports community. That concerns me deeply, that the folks who voted or who participated in this survey believe that a fee is necessary to help support the use of paddle sports in Oregon, but they don't believe that, that this agency has the ability to implement that. On most of the rivers and lakes that I paddle on, I pay a use fee today. They're operated on federal land, state lands, or on county lands, and we pay parking fees and other use fees to get into those facilities. If we look at a waterway like the Deschutes, it has very effectively implemented a pay-per-use fee that has funded the development of access, and there's campgrounds as well as porta potties and all of that that are maintained through this use system, and it's a pay per use on that river, and the funds go directly to support that river system. I believe that Oregon voters, when they filled out these surveys, were anticipating a use fee much more similar to that they're very familiar with and already support with their funding than a pay per person fee on an annual basis. If we look at it, it also seems to unfairly yoke the cost of this service to private boaters as opposed to commercial boaters. So if I own a livery and have 50 rafts in a 10-week season and do 10 rentals per week with 5 people per raft, that's about 25,000 user days on the river. That equates to a $200 use fee paid by that livery, equating to about $0.008 per use day of a river user. So they're paying less than a cent to use that, while a private boater is paying it at least $4 to get on the water. And that seems unfair to me, that the commercial folks can pay so little while the amount of usage and the demand on facilities like bathrooms is so much higher for a commercial use. Finally, I do think that there are a number of other groups like the Oregon Whitewater Association. We get private donations of about $20,000 a year from all over the state and companies to support reduced cost training programs for safety as well as first aid training that are already being provided. In summary, I think that while I support the idea that there is fair use or there should be payment for use, I don't think this implementation appropriately addresses the needs of the Oregon people.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. We're talking about fun here, boating. I'm Ron Hilbert. Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. I've been boating since I was 26 years old. 48 years. I've done about everything within the industry you can think of, from working for manufacturers all the way to becoming the national cruising chairman for the American Canoe Association, and teaching all 50 states on how to run safe canoe trips. I've taught personally over 5,000 people. The list goes on forever, the things that I've accomplished. But I oppose this legislation. In a meeting with the Northwest Rafters Association, which I belong to, in Oregon on February 9th, Scott Bruin and Marianne McKenzie was asked a question by myself. I like Scott. He is not like some of the bureaucrats I've dealt with in California. I've only been in Oregon 3 years. I basically ask him, a permit gives me permission to do something. What is that? And Scott said if the law passes, this permit allows you to be on the waterway in a boat. Charging a permit or tax on Oregon waterways is clearly a violation of the Oregon Admissions Act, which states that all the navigable waterways of said state shall be common highways and forever free without any tax, duty, impost, or toll thereof. You cannot tax somebody or charge them a fee to go on a waterway that are owned by the people of Oregon. This was also in California. We ran into the same problem in the 70s, and this is a statement by the Attorney General of California that has the same admission as Oregon. And they, back in the 70s, realized that that was a problem. They solved it by charging parking fees and launching fees. As far as education goes, we already have education available through paddling schools, the American Canoe Association, all kinds of other organizations nationally and locally, paddling clubs. I will state that the state of Oregon, recently dropped similar legislation. Marianne McKenzie said it was modeled after Oregon's non-boating permit program. And another thing I would like to make clear is the last time I checked, there were now 9 drownings in Oregon. Statistically, the drive to get to the river and the shuttle is the most dangerous part of a river trip, statistically. A 6-hour raft trip gives the rafter odds of 1 in 100,000, or exactly the same risk for each hour in a raft as 100 miles in a car, discounting all but fatal accidents. Voluntary education, again, is great. There are a few points that I can see in this legislation that are good, but I think there has to be a different solution. And I respectfully request this proposed legislation be withdrawn. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Questions for this panel?
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for your testimony today.
Can I submit this?
Yes, sir. To the clerk
thank
over
you.
Here. Is anyone else? I have Mr. Wolf and Mr. Rollator, if you can get it done in 2 minutes. Otherwise, we'll be hearing this again on Wednesday next. You're standing between us and adjournment, gentlemen.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport. I'm on the ALSI Port Commission, which is our local estuary. Our port takes no position on legislation. However, I'm here today testifying on my own behalf. Many, many places in our estuaries are best explored by small boats. And the places that we put those in are unimproved sites, and they're really not very safe. The other morning on my way to work, I almost ran into a couple of guys standing in the middle of the road in the dark, putting their boat in the river, and they could have gone downstream 50, 75 feet and had a safe place to park. So we really need this bill. And it'll help us rectify that situation for safe places to park and places to access. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rollator. Mr. Wolf, welcome.
Well, Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with the Trout Unlimited. I have submitted written testimony, so I'll be very brief. Trout Unlimited has 3,200 members in the state, and I would say 80% of those own some sort of non-motorized boat that they use, because as most fishermen realize, the only way to really access waters efficiently is in a non-motorized boat. I myself own a 9-foot pontoon boat that I can use both on rivers and lakes. We support this bill. We understand that to do their mission, the Marine Board needs more money. We understand the concerns of the Whitewater people. If there's some way that we can talk and work out their concerns, that would be great. But we think that this fee is needed for the Marine Board to do their mission, and we strenuously support HB 2320. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank Questions you. For our panel? All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2320. Mr. Walker, a little preview of next week, please.
One moment, please, while I pull that up. I think primarily next week we will be having public or informational hearings with the transit agencies, TriMet, Coos Transit, and Rogue Valley Transit, and we will probably be working the House Bill 2482 with the Dash 3 amendments. We will rehear House Bill 2910 while Mr. Barreto's here, and I believe that's just about it.
Thank you very much. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you all. Thank you very much. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you all.